You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Ladies and gentlemen, if I could have your attention, I think we should get started. Good morning. My name is Richard Bush. I'm a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and director of its Center for East Asia Policy Studies and the holder of the Jun Fu and Cecilia Yen Gu Chair in Taiwan Studies, which is a great honor. But it's my privilege this morning to welcome you to our event, Taipei and Beijing, Opportunities and Challenges in Cross-Strait Relations Under New Conditions. We're co-sponsoring this event very gladly with Taiwan's Association of Foreign Relations. We're very pleased that at some point, my good friends Ray Burkhart and Joe Donovan will join us. Our motivation for doing this conference was the obvious observation that the world is changing more rapidly than usual. So just in East Asia, China has a relatively new leader, and he has a policy agenda that is quite different from that of his predecessor. President Ma Ying-jeou has 20 months to run in his presidency, and the focus of attention is shifting to the future. There's a lot of discussion now and debate about the future trajectory of Chinese external policy and U.S. external policy and what that means for the rest of us. And so it seemed quite appropriate that we examine the implications for cross-strait relations of these new trends and these new conditions. Before we really begin, it's my obligation to acknowledge the efforts of a lot of people who made this event possible. We're grateful to all the speakers and moderators and commentators. My staff at the Center for East Asia Policy Studies, who worked very hard to turn an idea into a reality. Next, the staff of the Association of Foreign Policy, Foreign Relations of Taiwan. They did the same. And in particular, I need to acknowledge the efforts of Dr. Huang Kuibo, who is the Secretary General of the Association and a former visiting fellow at Brookings. I need to note that the ROC's Mainland Affairs Council facilitated the participation of the Taiwan delegation in this event. The Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies provided this space. The competition for function rooms over across the street at Brookings is pretty intense this fall. So now I would like to call on my good friend Zhao Jianmin to say a few things, and then we'll get started. Jianmin?
Dr. Bush, Doc, good friends, ladies and gentlemen, good morning. As a co-founder of the Taiwanese delegation, I'd like to extend my gratitude for the Center for East Asia Policy Studies, especially Dr. Bush, at the Brookings Institution and the Association of Foreign Relations for co-hosting this conference to discuss opportunities and challenges in the Taiwan Strait area. Relations between Taiwan and mainland China have made a great stride in the past 5-6 years. But as the law of physics dictates, there's high tide and there's not too high tide. The emphasis of the conference its new conditions. I think it is most opportune and timely. With the participation of scholars from around the world, I'm sure many of the findings will find their way out of the Washington, D.C. Beltway and generate a far greater impact. Again, my thanks go to Dr. Bush and Dr. Huang Kuibo for their efforts to make this happen. And wish the conference a great success. Thank you.
So if I could ask the participants in the first panel to come on up. And while they're doing so, I will give you the most important piece of information you will hear today, and that's the location of the restrooms. They're downstairs. I think you go into the lobby and downstairs, but the people out there can help you. So I turn the chair over to my good friend David Brown. David, thank you.
Good morning, everyone. As Richard said, my name is David Brown, and I'm affiliated with SAIS, and as such, I'm particularly happy to welcome this conference to our facilities and say how happy we are to make them available. This is a panel that will focus on opportunities and challenges in cross-strait relations, and I think the sponsors deserve a lot of credit for putting together a remarkable panel of distinguished scholars and practitioners, and a panel that I think will present a diverse series of perspectives on this issue. After 5 years of relative success by President Ma Ying-jeou in implementing his new cross-strait policy, for about the past year since the signing of the Services Trade Agreement, new issues have arisen in Taiwan that have created challenges for Beijing and for Taipei in moving their shared agenda forward. And I hope this panel will shed some light on what those challenges are. We have with us today Professor John Hsieh from South Carolina, Professor Wong from Dankang College in Taiwan, Doug Paul to my left, and Alan Romberg to my right, from respectively the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and the Simpson Center. And we have Professor Zhao from American University. Their bios are in your paperwork, and so I will not do more to introduce them. I think they are all well known to people in the audience. And I have a challenge, and that is that this is a panel with five eminent practitioners who I am going to have, I suspect, a little trouble disciplining. If we're going to have time at the end for an exchange with the audience, I'm going to have to ask each of them to try and keep their remarks to about 10 minutes or at most 12 in hopes that that will leave about a half an hour for discussion. And with that, I would like to ask Professor Hsieh to begin by making his remarks.
Thank you, David. Ladies and gentlemen, it's indeed a great honor for me to come to this occasion. And before I start, I would like to thank the Center for East Asian Policy Studies, Brookings, and also the Association of Foreign Relations for inviting me to this conference. And I see my job as essentially to try to delineate a very broad picture about the cross-strait relations. And my own assessment of the cross-strait relations is that in the past 3 decades or so, and it has been relatively stable. And one indication on the stability is that there has not been a very serious military confrontation, for instance. Of course, there was a missile crisis in 1995-96. But generally speaking, it seems to be reasonably stable. And I think the one very important reason for the stability is the pivotal role played by the United States. And the United States actually laid down some groundwork and for for managing the relation between China and Taiwan and so on. And I think the U.S. Certainly is very much concerned about peace and stability in the region. And the U.S. policy can also be summarized actually quite simply. And it's kind of on the one hand, on the other. And on the one hand, certainly the U.S. Adopt the one-China policy to try to placate China. And but on the other hand, the United States also warned China not to use force against Taiwan. And with regard to Taiwan, the U.S. continued to provide military arms to Taiwan so that Taiwan would be able to defend itself against a possible Chinese attack. And but on the other hand, the U.S. also tried to discourage Taiwan from taking very drastic actions to provoke China and so on. And the U.S. also maintained some kind of ambiguity and with regard to its degree of involvement in a possible military conflict between China and Taiwan. So this kind of policy seems to be receiving some kind of bipartisan support in Washington, at least at a very broad level. And so no matter what this Republican administration or Democratic administration and so on, they seem to all adhere to that kind of policy stand. So I think this indeed lay down the kind of framework for the kind of a relation that we see across the Taiwan Straits. And in the 20, 30 years ago, of course, the U.S. was the preponderant superpower. And so it certainly has a lot of leverage vis-a-vis the other two players in this triangular relations. And now with the rise of China, of course, the leverage that U.S. May have, it's not only U.S. but also Taiwan as well. And vis-a-vis China has been diminishing. And I would argue that the basic structure remain quite similar. And this particularly reflect the kind of preferences that each party may have vis-a-vis with regard to the relations across Taiwan Straits. And so I think that at least in the next several years, and I don't see that this will change very drastically. So we can still see this may, some kind of a picture may continue to be the case for a number of years. And the stability doesn't also reflect the relative stability of the preferences for the Chinese leaders. And ever since Deng Xiaoping took over power in the late 1970s, early 1980s, and also launched economic reform, he already set the tone for the Chinese foreign policy, or Chinese policy toward Taiwan in particular. And he mentioned very clearly that China needs to try to achieve unification with Taiwan. But at the same time, China also needs to modernize, and meaning economic development. And he particularly emphasized that in order to achieve other goals, and China needs to develop its economy first. So as long as China develops its economy, then all the other problems can be accomplished. And that's basically what he was talking about. And he also tried to make sure that in order to develop China's economy, then it's paramount that China needs to seek a peaceful international environment, which means, of course, to cooperate, to work with the United States, and not to make too much trouble as well in different parts of East Asia. And so that's, of course, including the relation with Taiwan. And so he already set the tone that this economic development should take precedent over issues even like Taiwan, which is quite emotional. And so that's become the kind of Chinese standard policy, not only during the Deng era, but also for his successor as well. Even today, even though we see Xi Jinping seems to be more assertive in some ways, but I think this general tone or this very overall goal that China tried to pursue as kind of national goals, I think remain still quite valid. And so all this provides some kind of stability and to the cross-strait relations. I think the probably when we see the kind of ups and downs, at least in the short-term fluctuations across the Taiwan Straits, sort of has something to do with Taiwan, basically. And I think this also reflects Taiwan is a democracy now. And as a democracy, then there are many different kind of voices, different kind of attitudes, and towards relations with China in particular. So there are people who are in favor of Taiwan independence and to be separate from China for good. There are also people who want to unify with China, and there are also a lot of people who are somewhere in between, and they support something called status quo, which means neither unification nor independence. And according many polls, for instance, roughly 50 or close to 50% of the population in Taiwan support the status quo, and about 25-30%, sometimes even more, for Taiwan independence, then about 15-20% for unification. And sometimes, of course, the figure would be even lower. And but this this kind of distribution actually has been relatively stable to some extent, even though we see some gradual increase on the independence side and some decrease on the unification side. But the general picture has not really changed that much. And also survey after survey, and we can find that the this kind of division become really the most salient cleavage in underpinning Taiwan's party politics. So the DPP represents the independent side, the KMT represents the unification side. But of course, the most interesting is really about the people who support status quo and which party they turn to. And according to most of the surveys I have been doing with, I don't know how many surveys I've done, and also get involved. And quite interestingly, and about two-thirds, oftentimes, or two-thirds or more, of the status quo supporters, they support the KMT. And this quite obvious and also reasonable because understandable because KMT represents the status quo, and status quo meaning that the country is called the Republic of China, and the national flag is the same one that the KMT brought to Taiwan, and the same national anthem and the constitution and so on. All these were something that those people who support independence they don't really like, and so in Taiwan parts actually it's really a division between pro-independence and something not so pro-independence. And that's also why actually the KMT or the so-called blue camp continue to be the larger of the two major camps in Taiwan's politics. But this is really the kind of basic dynamics, domestic dynamics in Taiwan. And this also, of course, have repercussions with regard to the cross-strait relations. So it really depends on who controls the governing power. And if there's a KMT government, and then we can expect that the policy toward China probably were more kind of cordial or something. And then if the DPP can actually comes to power, and even though it also depends on who which candidate will win the election and so on, who actually will be in charge, of course, this also makes some differences. And some leaders are more pragmatic. And but given the strong suspicion on the, by the Chinese leaders told the DPP, certainly we can expect not necessarily tensions, but at least some kind of problems across the Taiwan Strait. So this is the kind of general picture that we can see. So at least from a very broad picture, and we see some kind of stability and at the international level. And but we do see some fluctuations resulting from the internal dynamics in Taiwan's politics. So for instance, 2 years from now, there will be in 2016, there will be new elections. Who knows who's going to get elected? And if the KMT continue to win the election, and then also very likely they're going to win the legislative yuan, that is the parliament, and then we will see a unified government in Taiwan, and so that would be one scenario. And but it's also likely that the DPP candidate may win the election. I will refrain from using gender terms here. And so a DPP person gets elected, say, in 2016. And then, but generally speaking, it's quite difficult for the DPP to control the legislative yuan. I mean, they don't have time to get into the detail about the different type of elections, how now these how the various political parties will fare in different kind of electoral under different kind of electoral contests. But generally speaking, it's not that easy for the DPP to control the legislative yuan. So it's very likely that there would be some kind of divided government situation. and just like what we see in 2008. And so this actually imposed some kind of constraints upon the DPP leader, if the DPP leader became the new president. And so this, but then also there's another level, you know, that of direct cross-strait relations, and how the DPP administration will be able to deal with China and so on. But anyway, this there will be some kind of uncertainty over there. And moving back a little bit to the more near term, that is, there are still about 20 months until May 2016 that President Ma will be in office. And then what will happen? And I think this depends upon many factors right now. And we see a lot of very serious stalemate in Taiwanese politics at this moment. I mean, anyone in Washington D.C. is familiar with stalemate, gridlock. I mean, in the U.S. Between the U.S. Congress and the administration and so on. Also similar in the case of Taiwan. But it's kind of ironic because the KMT actually controls majority of the seats in the legislature, in the parliament. But unfortunately, KMT is not very cohesive. So there's a pro Ma Ying-jeou faction, also the pro Speaker Wang Jinping faction, and so on. And so they don't really work that closely together on certain issues. So this is quite unfortunate for President Ma if he really wants to implement his policy, his pet project with regard to the cross relations. And then there's also the problem with the general political atmosphere in Taiwan. And on the one hand, I think the President Ma's approval rating has not been that great. And over the years, for a lot of reasons, a lot of different kind of factors which contribute to that, ranging from, for instance, disaster relief and to American beef, for instance, all kind of problems. And his approval rating has not been very high. And also after the March-April sunflower seed movement, this further constrained the hands of the KMT, for instance, the KMT MPs and also the KMT government, and doing something about China, and then also they're going to be a very important local election in late November, and as expected, the KMT probably lose some seats and lose some races, but how serious that would be, so that also will determine the kind of policy that President Ma would be able to put through. And so this certainly will affect, because everything still, a lot of important bills still need to be passed through the legislative process. And since the KMT has not really been that cohesive so far, and so I think if the President Ma really wanted to achieve something, probably this one very important problem he needs to solve. And if, for instance, the KMT also didn't do well in the elections, in the forthcoming local election, of course, this will further tight the hands of the KMT, not only Ma himself, but also many KMT MPs as well, because they have to think about their own personal re-election bids. And so they have to be very careful about what kind of stand they are going to take, particularly for those people who are elected from the single-member district part, not necessarily the people from the proportional representation portion of the election. And then there's also another problem which I think bothered this administration. And also, actually, this has become a kind of permanent thing in Taiwan. That is about the legislative process and the legislative procedures and how the opposition will be able to boycott, for instance, to block many bills in Taiwan. And in most of the Congress or parliaments, of course, you allow the minorities to have some room of maneuvering so that they would be able to do something to delay or even to block sometimes certain kind of bills they extremely dislike, and that's normal, that's not a real problem. But when this become really just constant and constant thing, of course, just like what a lot of people, when we see what happened on Capitol Hill in Washington D.C. when this become truly a kind of permanent thing, then you have really to think about how to solve the problem here. How can really get things going? And so this, but of course, I don't think that President Ma will have enough time to solve this kind of problem. Also, given the kind of division within the KMT itself, and I think that any kind of reforming the legislative process would not be likely in the foreseeable future. So these are all the contextual factors, which of course will affect what will happen during the remaining years for President Ma's terms. And but of course I can feel that President Ma is quite anxious and to try to get something done in the cross-strait relations. And but there are a lot of other factors that will affect his efforts. I'll stop here.
Professor Ish, thank you very much. I'd now like to turn to Professor Wong and ask you certainly can make his presentation.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's my honor to attend this conference. I would like especially to express my thanks to the Center for East Asian Policy Studies of Brookings Institute and the Association for Foreign Relations of Taipei to give me this opportunity to come here. My topic, according to the task assigned by the host, will be focused on mainland China's policy toward Taiwan and the cross-strait relation. I will use PowerPoint to highlight my viewpoint. My talk will divide into three sections. First is about the mainland China's policy toward Taiwan. I think that China's policy toward Taiwan from Hu Jintao's period to Xi Jinping's right now has contained the following important elements. China still insists on the One China principle and therefore accepting the so-called 1992 consensus. But for Beijing, I think it has already made a more flexible definition of the One China principle. Regarding the cross-strait arena, right now China defines One China principle as both mainland and Taiwan belong to One China without clear referring who will represent that China. That makes more equal status across the strait. Second, right now both sides also have a common ground on the so-called 92 consensus. But for Taiwan, the 92 consensus means one China with different interpretation. Although Beijing actually did not really accept this definition, but it still right now can tolerate because at least Taiwan can accept partially the One China principle. Second, Beijing's policy to Taiwan still insists on opposing any movement toward pursue independence of Taiwan. Second, the cross-strait policy of Beijing can be called as the peaceful development relations. Because Beijing knows that it cannot achieve its final goal of unification immediately. So far, it would like to maintain a peaceful and a cooperative relation with Taiwan and make this as a preparation for the future unification across the strait. Beijing do what it can to strengthen the economic and social ties across strait. The proven of that is 21 agreements have already been signed with Taiwan, including the Economic Cooperation Framework Agreement. Fifth, Beijing allowing some limited room for Taiwan's international participation without creating the consequence of two China or one China and one Taiwan. For example, since 2008, Taiwan has been able to participate the WHA annually as an observer since 2009. And last year, Taiwan also can attend the ICAO Congress as a guest. That's the two obvious result from this policy. Although Beijing right now mainly focuses on the economic and social relation across strait, but it hasn't given up to push the political relation across the strait. Hu Jintao made a very important speech in the end of 2008 by proposing that the two sides can start to discuss the creation of a peace agreement and the CBMs across the strait. After Xi Jinping took power, he still stick to that position. He met a delegate last year from Taiwan, saying that the political issue across the strait should not be put off indefinitely from his mouth. Okay, that summarized, I think, the basic policy of Beijing so far toward Taiwan. And how about that consequence on the current cross relation? I think that the cross relations had progressed well since 2008, after President Ma become the president of ROC, because the Ma administration, like I just mentioned, can accept the 92 consensus, and Beijing is glad to have Taiwan to take that position, so that the representative of institution that is the Strait Exchange Foundation of Taiwan and the Association of Relations Across Taiwan Strait has resumed talk since 2008, and these two institutions has already negotiating and signed 21 agreements between the two sides, and these agreements cover many areas for cooperation. And to further upgrade the institutional and the political contact, Beijing invite the Minister of Mainland Affairs Council, Wang Yuqi, to visit mainland China this February and meet with his counterpart, the Minister of Taiwan Affairs Office, Zhang Zijun, in Nanjing, February this year. And also, according to the poll done by the MEC, the majority of Taiwanese were quite satisfied with the development of the cross relation so far. A poll done in early March, that's before the occurrence of the so-called the Sunflower Movement, the result of the poll showed that 44.8% of people feel that the pace of the cross relation is just fine. Actually, they are 14.2% thought it's moved too slow. Only 31.3% thought it moved too fast. So we can see that actually most people think that the pace are just fine or should can be moved faster. But however, the occurrence of the so-called Sunflower Movement in Taiwan on March 18th, I think has changed this course and stalemated the cross relations. I will not elaborate the Sunflower Movement. I saw that most of you know that some students occupied Le Shi Yuan and opposed the ratification by the LY to pass the service trade agreement signed by the two sides. Because of this movement, I think there's four consequences that impede the further development of the cross-relation. First, it has stopped the ratification of the cross-strait service trade agreement, which is important part of the ECFA. The students agreed to leave the relationship only after the speaker of the LY, Wang Jinping, promised that he would not summon a meeting of all parties to discuss the passage of that agreement before a supervisory act on the cross agreement was passed. So right now that supervisory act hasn't been discussed and passed yet. So the cross service agreement cannot be ratified so far, although it has been signed already 14 months already. Secondly, the negotiation on the cross trade goods trade agreement has also been deferred. And this agreement is also a very important part and even more important than the service trade agreement of the ECFA. But since the stalemate of this agreement, Beijing actually showed very little incentive to continue this kind of talk because Beijing thought that even it is completed, it cannot be passed in the Legislative Yuan. There's no much interest in pushing that negotiation. But actually, although the talk on this agreement already resumed on September 10th in Taipei, but still the progress is not very quick. Thirdly, the cross-strait agreement supervision act restrained the development of cross-strait relations in the future because the student group and the DPP require a more restrictive law on supervising and monitoring the negotiation and the signing of any cross-strait agreement in the future. If that act was passed in the Legislative Yuan, we can see that even it's not unlikely, but it will be very difficult for the Ma administration to negotiate a new agreement and have it been passed by the Legislative Yuan. First, the Sunflower Movement revealed that many people in Taiwan were still not very satisfied with the Ma administration, the mainland policy, and the development of the cross-strait relations in the last few years. Actually, a poll done in July by MAC regarding the past of cross-strait, we have seen the difference already. Right now, only 36.4 people thought that the past was just fine. Actually, 36.8 people thought that the past moved faster and surpassed the past, those people who feel that the past are just fine. We will see that is different from the poll done in March before the Sunflower Movement. So given this kind of social feeling, I think that the Ma administration also will feel pressure in dealing with the China in moving the cross-strait relations very quickly. Okay. Another thing I think the two sides still at odds with regarding Ma's participation of the coming APEC. I will not elaborate that issue. Lastly, for the last remaining time, I will talk a little about the prospect of cross-relation. I think that the cross-relation before the end of President Ma's second term in May 26th will still remain stable because the two sides still have the common ground of 1992 consensus. And actually, there's no sign to show that Beijing will change its current conciliatory policy to Taiwan so far. Zhang Zijun actually visited Taipei in June this year. I think before Ma finished his term, the cross-strait region will still remain stable. But I think the unpredicting uncertain comes after 2016 Taiwan's presidential election. If the KMT wins the election, I think the cross-strait region will still remain the same as the present. But if the DPP, which did not accept the 92 consensus, wins the presidential election, have no good agreement with the, Beijing on the political basis, we will see a new era of cross-relation, I think, with the vulnerability and the conflict in the future. Thank you for your attention. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Wong, for being succinct and clear in your statements. I'd like now to turn to Doug Paul and ask him to make his remarks.
Thank you, David, and thank you to all the organizers. I think this is the fourth year that the Mainland Affairs Commission has helped to sponsor these kinds of gatherings, and I think they're doing a very valuable service of reminding us of the things that are happening below the headlines in cross-strait relations. My two predecessors, Professor Xie and Professor Wong, have laid the groundwork pretty well, so I thought maybe I would make some observations from a Washington vantage point on pertinent aspects of where we are today and going forward. First, one question that always comes up is there still bipartisan support in Washington for a stable relationship between Taiwan and the mainland? I think it's fair to say that's probably true. It's difficult to test that. We've had a little bit of increase in congressional visits to Taiwan, and just this week we had some legislators visit Washington, and I did not detect particularly partisan or strong divisions on either side about the relationship between the United States and Taiwan and between Taiwan and the mainland. I think more pertinent is you have a situation where you have bipartisan distraction, where people are really focused on issues elsewhere. They're all in the headlines, ISIS, the Ukraine, Taiwan. Even with the scratchy year we've had with PRC in the South China Sea and East China Sea with relations with our allies and friends in that area, this has remained well below the fold of headlines in the newspapers because of these very significant surprises in American policy in Ukraine and the Middle East. We have a new phenomenon which is going to affect how I think Congress and the general public deal with issues that may arise in cross-strait relations, and that is this emergence of a new stay-at-home republicanism. We've had a very activist Republican Party for many decades. It's been part of the landscape, and usually following one line, not too divided. But Republicans have in recent years become more divided about where foreign policy ought to go. And I think we're going to see, as we go into this midterm and on to the presidential elections in 2016 here, increased vocalization of a desire for America to return home and be less involved overseas. You see that in the current debate over ISIS, where the president is really struggling to meet pressures to do something about a threat to the United States, but not commit us to a significant overseas presence in the process of doing that. As I mentioned, the U.S.-China relationship has had a very rocky or scratchy year. That's surprising in a sense looking back, because Obama did invite Xi Jinping to Palm Springs last June at the Sunnylands Summit in an effort to, early on in Xi Jinping's new term in office, identify some cooperative lines of endeavor between the United States and China and to try to reduce the potential for conflict. Both sides emerged from that meeting with a negative consensus statement that both sought to avoid the kinds of conflicts that have occurred between rising and established powers through history, and they were able to state that. But unfortunately, within 3 months, the U.S. and China were back into sort of more bickering than cooperation. Below the surface, there's always cooperation. There's always more going on than people can see. But at the superficial level, the Chinese activities in the South China Sea and the East China Sea and the usual problems we have almost on a calendrical basis, where every spring we talk about the past Tiananmen, and the National People's Congress takes place in the spring, and things happen around that. It's the spring and summer, you usually have a kind of noisy period anyway. And then leaders start to meet in the fall. We're going to have three meetings this fall, the East Asian Summit, the G20, and APEC in Beijing. And so I think you're going to see a more cooperation emphasized as the leaders actually get together, rather than having their junior officials standing far apart from each other for most of the year, throwing rhetorical stones at each other. A big part of this past year's difficult relationship was the declaration by China of the Air Defense Identification Zone for Northeast Asia, and to be followed 6 months later by China's very substantial civil fleet accompanying a maritime supervision fleet accompanying a drilling rig into the South China Sea in waters that China claims and Vietnam also claims. This has led to statement after statement where the U.S. says this has been provocative, aggressive, assertive, and the Chinese respond with equal vituperation. This is not the best atmosphere for U.S.-China relations, and it certainly has historically been the case that when U.S.-China relations are not being well managed, it gets a little harder to deal with cross-strait relations. Inevitably, toward the end of this administration, there will be another round of U.S. arms sales to Taiwan, and Taiwan has many needs, and the U.S. has a broad consensus that the it should help to meet those needs. How PRC will react will, I think, will depend in great measure on the quality of the U.S.-China relationship that prevails at the time. I should take a footnote here and point out that despite this rocky period, we've had a new high point reached in U.S.-China relations in military-to-military contacts and interaction. Just this week at Carnegie, we hosted the Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Greenert, who described his recent four encounters, and I think this week there's a fifth encounter with Admiral Wu Shengli, his counterpart, head of the Chinese Navy. This was not going on in the previous years, not since the 1980s, and to my mind, this has been a very constructive element within this more strained atmosphere. One of the things that I think has struck a lot of people is that Xi Jinping has become the personification of a much tougher attitude toward China's neighbors generally. It's peculiar that China would have a scratchy relationship with, or quite conflictual relationship with Japan and Vietnam and the United States in some respects all at the same time. And this seems to have buried the concept of Tao Guangyanghui, where sometime last year, even though China was proclaiming a need for good neighborly relations, this will color the relationship going forward. On Taiwan domestic politics, I've been struck at how the DPP has approached this lingering issue of not being able to formulate a policy on how to handle one China. It was a source of some friction between the United States government and the DPP prior to the last presidential election. We were asked to trust that there would be a good outcome from the election, that the DPP would not do anything provocative toward the mainland. But it was not based on a convincing explanation of what its cross-strait policy was going to be. This year, there's been a little bit of experimentation by the DPP to see what that policy might be. But I believe that's been basically shut down until the 9-1 elections take place later this fall, because it would be distracting from the election. But I'm getting signals from people in the DPP that next year they are going to try to wrestle with this issue and see if there's a policy stance consistent with the DPP's long-standing principles, but also would be convincing to outside observers that Taiwan is, and the DPP is prepared to have a complicated and positive view toward the cross-strait relationship. And just finally, on the services trade agreement, I can understand the people's feelings in Taiwan. This is really, if you travel the world broadly, Taiwan is no exception to the rest of the world. That people are uncomfortable with globalization, uncomfortable with the reduced job opportunities for young people, and living with lower levels of growth. But I would point out that Taiwan has actually had two very good quarters by international standards. This last month, exports boosted 18%. Very few places can make these kinds of claims. And the services trade agreement is an opportunity for Taiwan to do even better. Taiwan is uniquely the beneficiary of a much more advanced services trade base in their own economy than the PRC has. And a cross-strait services base agreement is going to be more advantageous to Taiwan. So I hope the Taiwan authorities and the legislator can get to the point where they can bring this to fruition so that Taiwan can have the fruits of those additional elements of trade as well. Thank you.
Doug, thank you very much. And now I'd like to turn to Alan Romberg.
Thank you very much. Very quickly, let me say thank you to the sponsors, if I want to stay within my 12 minutes and not get wrapped by Dave Brown. In a way, this topic, and I've been asked to look at the opportunities and challenges under the, quote, new conditions from a PRC perspective, and in a way that topic can be covered in about 2 minutes, not 12. That is, Beijing hopes to achieve more and is going to foster all sorts of progress if it can, but basically it doesn't believe there's much scope in Taiwan for big breakthroughs, and so beyond garden tenting, it's going to largely focus on two things. First, doing what it can within the existing framework to deepen exchanges and to win hearts and minds. And second, to pay a lot of attention to the upcoming elections, especially the 2016 election, and try to figure out how best to serve its long-term interest in ultimate reunification through short and medium-term focus on peaceful development of cross-strait relations. In the process, however, it seems to me it's not likely, at least at this point, that Beijing believes that flexibility in implementation is necessarily in its interest in areas such as international space, be it economic or political. That may prove wrong over time, and one can certainly hope so, but I wouldn't hold my breath. If one looks back at PRC rhetoric last fall, it was full of robust statements about moving from peaceful development to peaceful reunification in the course of the great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation. And those themes are not totally absent today. Zhang Jiujun, when he was here recently, mentioned them again when he was in San Francisco. And one would be foolish to think that they have disappeared. But the combination of political stalemate in the legislature, the LY, which means that the services trade agreement, as several people have said, is currently going nowhere, and then the Sunflower Movement, which generated a lot of angst about cross-strait relations in general, as well as about the process of handling cross-strait agreements, made it painfully clear to Beijing that there really was no domestic space in Taiwan for cross-strait political dialogue and for progress on the agenda that the mainland had hoped to advance. So instead, what we see now is a refocus on cultivating a better image at the grassroots, which was a theme that had been talked about much a few years ago. Yes, they will continue to push for completion of the ECFA agenda, not only the services trade agreement, but also the commodities agreement and also a dispute resolution agreement over the next couple of years. But while those other agreements, that is the commodities agreement and the dispute resolution agreement, are complicated themselves, just as the services trade agreement was and is, I think Beijing is rather befuddled by the whole issue of the oversight bill, which has been mentioned, and what that may require and how it may impinge or will impinge both on negotiations and on the ratification process. So as a result, in some recent weeks, it dabbled a bit in high-pressure tactics to try to spur progress in Taiwan on the services agreement, but when that didn't seem to work, it's now gone back to a position of saying that it will always make beneficial arrangements for Taiwan, whatever other circumstances may obtain. Now, I don't think they're insincere when they point out that their hope that a PRC South Korea free trade agreement can be concluded before the end of the year. They may be overly optimistic about that timetable, but they do want it, and they are trying to make it happen. But now, rather than saying to Taiwan, gee, you know, it would be a pity if you lost the opportunity to get in first, instead they're saying, don't worry too much. That agreement will be implemented slowly, and it won't present an overwhelming challenge to Taiwan's exports. In any event, as they look beyond the ECFA agenda, I would argue the mainland has dropped its notion of new agreements on exchanges in areas such as culture, education, science and technology, and is going to focus mainly on maximizing what exchanges they can get without the umbrella agreements. There's a lot of talk, as you know, in Taiwan about breaking out financial services from the other items in the services trade agreement so that perhaps with Beijing's acquiescence they could get something moving in that area, even if the overall agreement is still stuck in the LY. I haven't seen a response from the mainland to that idea, but I could well imagine they might be open to such an arrangement, as it really would benefit both sides. The issue of a Ma Xi meeting, which has been raised here, of course, remains up in the air. But it does seem to me Beijing really would like such a meeting and has come up with some imaginative ideas about a possible venue beside Taiwan's preferred one at APEC, which seems not going to happen. But even if the venue issue can be resolved, that doesn't resolve issues relating to the status of the two sides, the status of the two participants, the agenda, or the desired outcomes. So this is a complicated issue. Meanwhile, Beijing agreed during Zhang Jiujun's visit to Taiwan to organize a joint study of the question of Taiwan's participation in regional economic activities. But if you look carefully at what's been said by the two sides, in fact, they don't really agree on the purpose of such a joint study, nor, as far as I can tell, has the PRC side come up with any ideas about how to proceed. Perhaps the most interesting and complex issue that the PRC faces over the coming year and a half of President Ma's remaining term is the question of what next. I don't think Beijing takes it as a given that current polling numbers in various municipal elections notwithstanding, the DPP is going to win the presidency in 2016. But they certainly see that possibility, and this poses some dilemmas for them. What if the DPP wins but really has not moved away from its advocacy of Taiwan independence to embrace a one China policy? I don't mean that the DPP expects that the DPP, that Beijing expects the DPP will advance a policy of declaring independence or return to policies that Beijing saw as highly provocative under President Chen Shui-bian. I mean, the issue for the mainland is how to handle a situation, both in the campaign and afterwards, should the DPP win, in which the party adheres through whatever formula to a position that Taiwan or the Republic of China is a sovereign independent state that has no connection to the mainland or to the PRC. That's a situation whether one sticks with the 1999 Kaohsiung resolution on Taiwan's future, or to the notion that Taiwan is the ROC and the ROC is Taiwan, or certainly any of the more provocative formulations in other DPP planks and resolutions. Now, we see the mainland is seeking to influence senior DPP people to move away from such notions and to acceptance, not necessarily of reunification, but at least of a one China framework in which the two sides are not viewed as separate from one another in the larger scheme of things. If we look back at the 2012 campaign, I would contend the DPP may not have been seeking to reassure Beijing, but neither was it seeking to promote a declaration of independence. Indeed, though I'm prepared to be corrected, it's my impression the DPP wanted to set the whole issue of one China aside, not to debate it, but to focus on a whole range of domestic issues in Taiwan where it had been critical of the Ma administration. And frankly, that's where I see it today. It may turn out that after the November elections, the DPP will actually take up the issue of a freeze of the 1991 Taiwan independence plank, and despite the strong views to the contrary within the party by some, it might approve such a freeze to demonstrate its sincerity. The plank does not represent the party's policy, even though such a freeze would have no effect on the sentiments of those in Taiwan who think the plank, in fact, reflects important and longstanding goals that existed long before the DPP existed. But in the wake of a number of statements and actions this spring, including, as Doug mentioned, the party setting aside the freeze issue at the National Congress in late July, and Chair Tsai Ing-wen's interview statement about how the PRC would shift in the direction of the DPP if it wins big in November, Beijing has reiterated in even clearer form than before its longstanding position. That position includes not only a requirement that for party-to-party relations, and of course for cross-strait relations should the DPP win, that the DPP must adhere to a one-China framework and abandon Taiwan independence, but it included a flat-out statement by the Taiwan Affairs Office that relying on the 1999 Kaohsiung resolution, quote, will not work. Now, maybe they've said that in so many words before, but it's been rare, if so. But the logic of making that statement is consistent, and there's nothing new in a fundamental sense. But the emphasis that Dr. Tsai has put on the 1999 resolution is not only a DPP consensus, but perhaps a Taiwan consensus, has led the mainland, I think, to seek to put that idea to rest. Moreover, they obviously felt constrained to rebut the notion that success in the November 29 election would cause Beijing to shift toward the DPP absent movement on the DPP's part to move in the direction I just discussed. Now, last time around, as the election campaign wore on, Beijing became more and more outspoken about its views until at the very end it made as clear as it could to the Taiwan business community that there would not be business as usual if the DPP won. It wasn't a matter of a military crisis that might happen, as it might have, for example, in 2008 had the UN resolution, or referendum rather, passed. But it was clear then, as one has to wonder whether it would not be clear again this year, that Beijing saw no basis for movement on a constructive cross-strait agenda if the administration in Taipei did not adhere to the positions that Beijing has laid out. Now, how explicit would the DPP have to be to overcome that problem? Frankly, I don't know. And I'm sure that will be the subject of a lot of messaging that's going to go back and forth through various channels over the coming months between the DPP and Beijing. But what I'm trying to say in the context of the subject that I was asked to address here, which is the PRC perspective, is that at the same time Beijing is seeking to advance as much as possible cross-strait trade, exchanges, and communication over the remaining months of President Ma's term, it will also be positioning itself to deal with any possible outcome in 2016. What one has to understand is that does not mean Beijing will compromise on its fundamental positions in order to make things work smoothly no matter what happens. But I do think it means that they will likely be examining closely what the true positions of the DPP are and to what extent, should the DPP win, they can be shaped to make them most compatible with PRC core positions. Thanks, Dave.
Alan, thank you very much, as always, for thoughtful comments. And now I'd like to turn to Professor Chow.
Thank you. In 33 years ago, in 1981, we had an Association of Asian Studies annual meeting in San Francisco. There is a panel, same title, Cross-Strait Relations and Future Prospect. Myself and Professor Hong Da-Chiu from University of Maryland, we just make separate presentations on ROC and PRC perspectives and points. And then 8 years later, when I had a public lecture at American University, the U.S. Foreign Policy Program Director, who now retired, a senior professor, asked me a question. Why you talk about cross-strait relations is your case study for Chinese foreign policy? I think in 5 years or 10 years, the issue will be solved. We will no longer talk about cross-strait relations. So if you look at now, we continue to discuss this issue decades by decades. So I think the issue itself remained very important, continue. Not only the cross-strait relations itself, mainland China and Taiwan, but also East Asia international relations, U.S.-China relations, among others. I have prepared a PowerPoint, but given the time constraint and many of the points already discussed early, so what I'm going to concentrate is my understanding of Beijing's perspective and concerns. The PowerPoint itself is started with historical review, with the current status, with the international factors and others, and many of the issues already addressed. What I'm going to say in the next, I hope, 6-7 minutes would be the six concerns from Beijing perspective. And particularly in light of the recent development and Taipei's proposal for a Xima Hui or Ma Xi Hui, that is a Xi Jinping Ma Ying-jeou meeting at the APEC. Use that as an example and to illuminate how Beijing's concern. The first concern, I would use a term, political trust. I think the political trust between the two sides still not fully established. The question regarding whether to have such meeting at APEC convention in about 2 months, is that what is Ma Ying-jeou's true intention? It seems like, from my understanding, that Ma Ying-jeou's number of public statements and concerns, so-called "亲美友日和路," that is to close to the United States, make friend with Japan, and also make a good relation with mainland China, is putting Ma Ying-jeou, seems like, to a neutral position, not necessarily can be fully trusted. That is, you know, even we can hear General Luo Yuan, when he made a public lecture at the Peking University, he challenged, what he said is whether Ma Ying-jeou is not Tai Du, but maybe Du Tai. You know, that's what that mean is that it's not Taiwan independence, however, it may not necessarily pro-unification. So that kind of question, I'm not saying that's a mainstream, but I'm saying that's a speculation. So in other words, the intention is not fully established. That comes to the second concern, is the so-called principle. We all understand that one China principle is always there from Beijing's perspective. Whether this kind of meeting would violate the principle, and particularly international, so-called international conditions in such meeting, and versus a domestic setting. And the third concern is that whether this kind of movement or kind of revenue is APEC would establish a norm. If that's a norm, so what should to do after 2016 if there is a regime change in Taipei? You know, early many presenters already talk about the possible DPP return to power, and then that would make Beijing in a very awkward position. Even though, my understanding, actually, there are a lot of discussion under the table now between Taipei and Beijing. From Taipei side, one of the arguments is we can pledge that not set up is a norm. However, it's not easy just to again, there is no enough political trust. And fourth concern is that whether this is a right stage or right time. One of the arguments is that if you look at any this kind of so-called summit meeting from two sides, it must already reached a certain stage, and then the two sides can produce some helpful either documents or result for cross-strait relations, so that to either develop or consolidate the current and the future relationship. So that's another concern and question. And the fifth concern is economic integration versus political development, so-called deep water. That is the political, there is a lot of a question if you really talk about the mainland China scholars and policy circles. And there is a re-examination about whether the economic policy really work. One of the schools of thought is if you promote economic relations, like ICFA and others, then naturally political relations may follow and then can move into so-called deep water. But it would not work, particularly if you look at the Mayflower and other Is that Mayflower? Sunflower. Sunflower and another campaign. It's making a lot of people now really had certain doubts about the utilities of this kind of approach. But again, what I'm saying is there are some debate concerns, not necessarily already said. That's actually the last concern, sixth concern, I argue, is security and international agenda. If particularly related to territory disputes, as like Sankaku Diaoyu dispute and the South China Sea, and this can be viewed as a testing stone, that is whether the two sides can really have some kind of consensus or even cooperation. But that's a lot of questions, a lot of hesitation from Taipei side. More importantly, I forgot who mentioned that, maybe Doug said whenever U.S.-China relations lower, then that would be more concern or more troublesome cross-strait relations. There are increasingly some voice from Washington saying that if you don't really cooperate in South China Sea, for example, then we may touch your core national interest, namely Taiwan issue, among others. So in other words, a soft spot. So again, Beijing might be concerned about whether Taiwan issue will be used again to aid U.S.-China relations, among others. So that's another view and a concern. So I may overemphasize some kind of questions or concerns. However, in my conclusion is that I do see there are huge progress with past Ma Ying-jeou 6 years. It's very different the situation now, but at the same time, I also see enormous uncertainty and the policies are re-examination across strait, particularly facing the uncertainty of 2016, and there are many, sometimes we can even use a term redefining cross-strait policy. Thank you.
I'd like to thank all of the panelists for very thoughtful remarks. I'm not quite sure how much time we have, but I'm going to assume that we have about half an hour for discussion. I think the panelists have put on the table issues which relate to both the shorter term, which is the next year and a half or so, the remainder of Ma's term, what can be, if anything, accomplished, and how the various parties in Taiwan will approach that and Beijing will approach it. And then secondly, a longer term question, what are the implications of the 2016 presidential election, and particularly the focus has been on the implications if the DPP should come back in office, though I would say that we also don't know who the KMT candidate is, and whoever that candidate is, it's almost certain that he will pursue or she will pursue policies that are different than those Ma has pursued, so there are uncertainties regardless who wins. I have some comments I would like to make, but if I keep talking, it's just the panelists addressing the audience. So first, I would like to open it up for questions. When you make a question, please identify yourself and be succinct. We're not interested in long comments, but in focused questions, which will draw out the panelists' views on this. Who would like to begin? Okay, I'll take this lady sitting in the front row here. Do we have a microphone, Kevin? We do.
Thank you. My name is Li Yang. I wonder if you can address the issues for the well-being of the general public in Taiwan, because I think the way have Taiwan and mainland China, PRC, I think historically I have a point is that now Taiwan is supported by U.S. U.S. is basically capitalist. And then capitalists then have a history of against communist. And currently the world issue is capitalists is in trouble because they resent the profit of people. So I just wonder if you can address the issues, how the DPT and KMT would address the issues of general public.
Thank you very much. I think we'll take a number of questions and then open up to the panelists. Can we have the gentleman in the far corner of the room?
Hi, my name is Xiao Lin. I'm a student in University of Maryland. I think before we talk about what can we accomplish in the early future, is that we need to see what's the what does Taiwanese people think about this issue. The mainstream opinion in Taiwanese people is that over 60%, based on the recent poll, over 60% of Taiwanese people is against the eventual unification with China. And any of these political and economic arrangement that wants Taiwan to abandon independence is against Taiwanese people's will. And if China want to do that eventually, then certainly he has to interfere with the democratic system in Taiwan by through the political and military forces or economic forces, but through Taiwanese business and doing business in China, which China can control their interest. So if that is the case, then it means that unification is anti-democratic and anti-Taiwanese people's will. So how do you comment on this situation? Thank you.
Thank you. Let's take a hand with a watch on it.
And with the watch, I'm like it should be a mainlander now. There are two questions I have. One for the American panelists. Doug, you mentioned that you anticipate at some point there will be another arms sale to Taiwan during the Obama administration's period, and I'd like to ask you and Alan to put on your analyst's hat and tell us what the conditions are that you think would lead to that. In other words, approximately what time frame we're looking at, or what conditions would eventuate that would lead to that. For our Taiwanese friends, I wonder if you could comment on the recent developments in Hong Kong and their impact inside Taiwan. How are Taiwanese viewing Beijing's 2017 NPC Standing Committee decision?
Good questions. One more from somewhere over there, the gentleman with his.
Hi. Oh, my name is Rongfei, and I'm a student at Islet School of International Affairs. My question is about the about Taiwanese society. So the Sunflower Movement is organized by the student. So as a Chinese, I have this sort of impression that the Taiwanese society is somehow divided. So the younger generation, for me, seems to be more radical. It's more for independent. And for the older generation, since they have more ties with mainland China, so probably they are more for pro one China policy. Is this understanding correct in a way that somehow the Taiwanese society is divided into two groups, sort of this young generation versus older generation? Thanks.
Okay, that's a good question. I think that gives us something for our panelists to chew on, and who would like to try and address some of those issues, particularly the ones related to Taiwan society?
Okay, let me say a few words about the public opinion in Taiwan, because it seems to be a concern for quite a few people here. And I think, indeed, I think Taiwan society is kind of divided. And sometimes it's not really easy for people to come together to agree on what kind of a future Taiwan should pursue, and so on. And but then, let me just give you some kind of opinions as seen in some opinion polls or surveys over the years. And generally speaking, I think Taiwan actually has been people's attitude toward the national identity issue, meaning independence versus unification, so has been reasonably stable, at least since the mid-1990s. And but of course, the general trend is that this is a gradual increase of the number of people who support independence, and somehow decrease on the other side, the unification. But the people who support the status quo remain quite constant, approximately 50, close to 50% of people who support the status quo. And but of course, the it all depends on how you ask the question. And for instance, in a lot of surveys, in addition to just simply asking whether you support independent unification or status quo, or you support, when you say you support status quo, then we ask whether you support status quo, then gradually moving toward independence or gradually moving toward unification, or you want to have status quo forever, or you want to status quo, then depends on the situation, then you want to decide what you are going to do next. And we also ask a bunch of other questions. For instance, there's one question which asks the respondents, if Taiwan declares independence, it's kind of a conditional question. If Taiwan declares independence and China will not attack Taiwan, then are you in favor of independence? And actually, quite a few people, and that's normally in most of the surveys, that would be over 60% of the population in Taiwan said that they are in favor of independence if China will not attack Taiwan. And but then if we ask them, if China becomes democratic, prosperous, and so on, can put, add all kind of modifiers here, and then are you in favor of unification with China? Then normally that number will be around 35-40%. So you can see the difference here. And also, for a lot of people, they in the regular survey, they answer they support status quo. Does that mean that they sincerely believe in the status quo? So it's just only, perhaps only the lesser evil or the second choice. And they are probably really in favor of independence or in favor of unification, but they feel that at this moment it's quite not feasible to achieve either. So they end up with the status quo. For a lot of people, that's kind of a rational choice for them. And but anyway, I myself have tried several different ways to try to disaggregate the people who support status quo, and to see what are their really sincere attitudes toward the issue. And oftentimes, after I divide them, roughly that would be sometimes one third, and sometimes a lot, slightly more for the independence, and then slightly smaller number for status quo, then followed by the people who support unification. So this kind of situation is difficult to change. And the recent trend, certainly you can see in a lot of polls, particularly after, say, 2012, and you do see some kind of generational gap. Actually, the youngest age cohort, say, from 20 to 29 and so on, and you do see a little kind of trend and moving toward independence. And but just gradual. It's not a very drastic change. And but then I also saw some polls just very recently, just a couple of months ago, and actually the situation actually moved back. So that means that actually the kind of distribution of the voters on this particular issue remained quite stable, and over time. And I don't think this will be easy solved, and this will be there, and Taiwan people just need to learn how to live with that. And this also underpinned the whole party structure and determined the dynamics in Taiwan's domestic politics. That's just a part of the life in Taiwan. And I think just like when people in Northern Ireland, they're Protestant, they're Catholic, of course, I think Taiwan is much more fortunate than that. And because at least in Taiwan, there's something called status quo in between. In Northern Ireland, either you are part of the Irish Republic, you are part of the Great Britain, and it's hard to find the midpoint to compromise. But at least in the case of Taiwan, there's a compromise position. And that may not be my first choice, but at least I can live with that. So at least in that sense, I think Taiwan will be able to maintain some kind of stability and so on for such a long time. Actually, it's quite stable despite this kind of division in society. Yeah,
thank you. Would you like to say something,
yeah, sure,
too, first of all?
I would like to respond to Scott's question. That I think that most Taiwanese people, they may necessarily pursue independence, because I agree with Dr. Xie's comment. The survey showed that the still majority of Taiwanese people support maintain the status quo. but few people support unification. The reason why they don't support unification is that they don't think the mainland China is a democratic regime, and also there's a disparity of culture and the economic conditions. So I think that the Hong Kong the case only shows first that China has no willing to promote democracy either in mainland China or in Hong Kong. Second, China used repeatedly say that the one country, two system to solve the Taiwan issues, but it seems to not workable. Even before this Hong Kong's case, already that method already few people accept in Taiwan because of the reason I just mentioned. But this case regarding Hong Kong further to prove that it's not workable either in Hong Kong or in Taiwan. So I think that the Hong Kong's situation will further strengthen Taiwan's impression about China, about the one China, two system, and about their attitude toward the unification. But however, I want to also mention that that means that it will substantially or significantly change Taiwan's political attitude, because I think just Dr. Fu Xifuzhen said, the reason why Taiwan's people, although they don't support unification, but they don't publicly grasp the idea of political independence, because that might put Taiwan in the risk of war with Beijing. So even with the case of Hong Kong, that means that suddenly Taiwan, all people will move to support the independence, because we have our own objective condition we should take care in thinking about this issue.
Thank you. Doug, you brought up the arms sales issue. Is there anything more you want to say on
that? Well, to answer, try to answer Scott's question, the PRC continues to develop its military capabilities, and it does not make an exception opposite Taiwan. So Taiwan has a changing military set of challenges, and it has its own, you know, need to upgrade in various areas to match those challenges, not to keep a balance or to have an offensive capability, but simply the minimum necessary defensive capability. The administration is under obligation through the Taiwan Relations Act to consider these factors, and every administration has to face this, not just the Obama administration. And then most administrations also want to manage their relations with the mainland successfully. And so you get into a very difficult game of trying, or it's more than a game, difficult choice, how to meet the requirements that we have under law in the United States to help Taiwan defend itself, and to do so in a way that doesn't push us in a direction of unnecessary friction or conflict in the West Pacific. And so each administration will have to make a decision. If I were in the administration, I would think 2015 is going to be a better year than 2016 to do something like this. But when and on what circumstances and with what material to be transferred will depend heavily on the lower level discussions about where the needs are. So I think you should expect something before the end of this administration, but precisely when will be subject to the conditions I've just outlined.
Alan?
Just two comments. First, on the arms sales issue, I agree with what Doug just said. I think there will be an arms sale. I don't know what it'll be. I don't know when it'll be, but it's, I think, pretty inevitable. Second, on the issue of unification and the polls, actually, and obviously Professor Xie looks at these polls very carefully, the ones I look at have an even higher status quo adherence. And the largest two categories are status quo indefinitely and status quo for a very long time, and then we'll think about it, as opposed to status quo, and then we'll go to independence, or status quo, and then we'll go to unification. But the question that was asked initially was, well, but 60% or more of the people oppose unification. Isn't this that they support it? It's that they oppose it. And I think that's an important point that Beijing has to have in mind. And I think it's a problem, and that it's been pretty consistent over a long period of time. I think it would be undemocratic if it were imposed on the people of Taiwan. But I think that the point that Professor Xie made, which is that people in Taiwan are quite rational, and therefore they're not opting for choices that will provoke the PRC to think it must take action against Taiwan is absolutely right, and I don't see a particular reason to expect a change either in Taiwan or in the mainland's approach to this. I don't see a reason to assume the mainland will get impatient with this and decide one morning, oh, gee, you know, we better go ahead and use force or something of that sort. I don't think that's a very likely approach, given all the other problems that the PRC has to face.
Thank you. I've just been given a note that limits our time, and so I'm going to say a few words myself, and they relate to the fact that most of the panelists in one way or another referred to the uncertainties about the 2016 election, and particularly uncertainties related to the DPP, possibility that the DPP may come back into office. There was uncertainty about the implications of a DPP victory in the 2012 election, particularly, I would say, here in Washington, that had some implications for how American policy was shaped. And as we look to the future, it seems to me that the DPP has some opportunities to alleviate those uncertainties if it wishes to take them. One set of opportunities relates to what Doug mentioned, and that is that they could, after the fall elections, local elections in Taiwan, come back to the question of the DPP's policy, either concerning the freezing of the party plank on independence or on the 1992 consensus, and try and come up with something that was pragmatic and possibly acceptable to the mainland as a basis for future cross-strait contacts when they come back in office. The other kinds of opportunities they have relate to the agenda of issues that was mentioned, and that is that there is the services trade agreement already negotiated before the LY. There is the possibility that by next spring we may either have an agreement on the exchange of offices between CEF and ARATS, which would then have to go to the LY, or conceivably, though less likely, we may have an agreement on goods in trade. And those, both of those two agreements are ones which the DPP has said they are not opposed to, and that I think they could see benefit in. So if the DPP were to approach those issues domestically from a pragmatic point of view, and both Su Jianchang and Lai Ching-de, when they came to Washington, tried to convey that the DPP was going to be more pragmatic in the future. So if they address those kinds of issues, not in the partisan way they are addressing the STA right now, but in a more pragmatic fashion, that may tell people something about how they would manage relations if they would come back in into power. And so with that, I think I am instructed to say that we're going to take a short break and resume at 10:50, which is about 10 minutes from now in this room. So would you please join me in thanking the panelists.